Hello, I'm Mischievous Marcinaccio, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, Amazing Fantasy number 15, and of course, all of the Amazing Spider-Man annuals, which, despite having them all in my collection, I say, do not count.
Yeah, I saw you posted about Amazing Spider-Man annual number 20, the Iron Man 2020 annual. I mean, that classic story.
And yes, it was my April 1st post, and I said that annuals count, Dan, so... Read that as you may.
I will, by ignoring the holiday. Well, anyway, I'm Dapper Dan Gavazin, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, also including the annuals, which I say definitely count, especially now that we've passed 2020. It turned out that that issue was prophetic. But for me, unlike Mark, Amazing Fantasy 15 remains a fantasy.
But man, wouldn't it have been a hoot if you posted like an Amazing Fantasy 15 yesterday? Like, I got it! April Fools.
Hey, if I wasn't flying all around the country looking to relocate, I definitely would have. I've been kind of off my social media game because I'm relocating back to Maryland from California, and there's a lot of work that goes into that. But enough about that. Let's talk about what we're doing today,
Dan,
Mark.
Because we are welcoming all of you to the Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic book universe. And thanks for joining us for this review episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
If you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, and future, make sure you subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review to help spread the word about our show.
This podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and of course, keep this podcast going, go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon.
Today on the show, Mark and I are going to be discussing Amazing Spider-Man Volume 6, Number 46. This issue was written by Zeb Wells. The cover features artwork by John Romita Jr., Scott Hanna, and Maury Hollowell. And interior artwork is by Carmen Carnero. Colors by Marcio Menez and Eric Arciniega, who was not credited in the actual comic. So another, I guess, miss there, like the misnumbering of the previous issue. Nick Lowe was sure to clarify that on Twitter, that Eric did, I think, 4 pages in the book. Let's finish this up by saying, of course, the letters were done by VC's Joe Caramagna. The issue was first released on March 27th, 2024. All right, Mark, issue 46, give us a recap.
You bet, Dan. The issue opens with panels of the Sinister Six. Mysterio, Vulture, and Kraven debate the merits of bringing back Sandman to the flock before Dr. Octopus puts the hammer down and demands they follow through, since a empty seat is an affront to all of us. Electro, with his feet up on the table, says he's got his orders loud and clear. Break into Ravencroft, fry anyone in his way, and bring Sandman home. And he's going to have fun doing it, I bet. The book flashes over to the East Village. Peter is leaving his apartment, thinking about the exchange he had with Sandman, except in this exchange, Sandman speaks proper English, in contrast to whatever language was being scripted in the prior issue, and says the Sinister Six are coming for him. Wow, could you imagine how simple storytelling could be in this context if you just say the thing you want to say instead of talking metaphorically? Peter knows. So Peter, deep in thought, bumps into Tombstone's lawyer, Michelle, and she's not very happy at all, accusing Peter of standing her up on a second date. Peter has no recollection of establishing that they might have had a second date. Michelle suggests otherwise, that he called her to ask her on a date, specifically to piss off Tombstone by dating his lawyer. Contrary to any rational thought, It sounds like Michelle was kind of turned on by Peter not seeming terribly interested in dating the lawyer of an underworld boss. And anyway, we get some awkward Peter for a few more panels. Michelle calls him a psychopath. And MJ is there in jackpot attire to rub the salt in the wounds a little more by saying, Parker still got it. That brings the events of this issue over to Ravencroft, where Peter and MJ are superheroed up, talking about how they are trying to be okay with the fact that they're seeing other people or attempting to see other people. Or MJ's with Paul, okay? We just need to remind everyone that MJ chose Paul over Peter, and whether anyone realizes it or not, it took her a long time to make that choice. MJ wonders if it's weird that she and Peter are teaming up to fight crime. And before I can answer, yes, Peter says no, and the two share a distant, far-off look to set up the next transition. Now we're inside Ravencroft, and Anna Watson and William are sharing a lovely moment with some geraniums. Their nurse reminds them to break up their romance and sends everyone back into their cells. The other inmates are all, aw shucks, so nice to Anna. The nurse jokes about Anna running for Ravencroft mayor, and Hippo says he'd vote for her, but I have to imagine Hippo is just like Gen Z, saying he's gonna vote, and then only like 11% of them actually show up to the polls every year. Anyway, there's an electrical surge in Ravencroft, and Spider-Man and Jackpot are back on the scene. Right on cue, Electro shows up and brings a whole bunch of electricity with him. He breaks out of Spider-Man's insulated webbing, an old trick dating back to the Ditko days, and Spidey's embarrassed. But Jackpot is here to spin the slot machine and come up with some form of magical power she can't anticipate. We're over in the cell block, and Mr. Hyde is organizing a very orderly jailbreak, much to Aunt Anna's chagrin. And despite her being the conscience of everyone, they remind her that they're villains, and villains are designed in Marvel Comics to break out of super prisons, whether they're Ravencroft, the Wrath, etc. It's probably the truest thing ever uttered in a comic. Meanwhile, Electro is about to send a deadly current through the mechanical arms that Jackpot created, but Spidey grabs Jackpot to protect her. As a result, they end up on top of each other, nose to nose. Ooh, baby, she's gonna leave Paul, I know it. Well, no, they need to get back to Electro, so maybe we'll put a pin in that moment. Or maybe we won't. Now, Electro is face to face with Sandman, who reminds Electro that he's no longer the artist known as Flint Marco. He's the artist formerly known as Flint Marco, aka William Baker, and I'm glad he said that because honestly, I forgot too. Electro is ready to turn Sandman into molten glass to get him to come with him, but Anna throws a deadly flower pot to protect her friend. But before Electro can deep fry Anna, Whirlwind and Hippo reappear and throw fisticuffs with Electro. Nobody hurts the mayor of Ravencroft. A statement which I have to imagine is the title of the next 6-episode Disney Plus show. To aid in their fight against the electric menace, Jackpot summons a pink bowling ball that hits Electro in the gut, and then the human fly pops out with some kung fu kicks, followed by Hippo just sitting on Electro with a helpful push from Spidey. As things close up, we get a montage and find out that because the inmates credit Anna with stopping the breakout, the guards let Anna leave Ravencroft early. Sandman is still in treatment, and Electro is on his way to the Wrath, where he'll definitely never escape. Peter and MJ share another moment, bonding over their camaraderie and perfect partnership before MJ throws cold water all over the prospects of them ever teaming up again. Back at Ravencroft, William is talking with the nurse about Flint not being there anymore, but just before you think he's fully reformed, the nurse is distracted by sand falling out of a flower pot and William disappearing into thin air. She screams for a medic, but William is gone. Turns out that Anna mistakenly took home Flint Marco, disguised as a flower pot, only for him to be reunited with the Sinister Six, Electro 2. As the issue ends, we don't find out why they've reunited, living brain, but Otto promises to explain his plans either in a future issue or off-panel. My guess is that we've got some obscure one-shot that will lay this entire thing out. And folks, I just need to add that Dan had to clean up the ending of this synopsis because I actually didn't quite understand the ending of what happened in this comic. So we will get to that in our review. Take it away, Dan.
What? Well, speaking of not ending or not understanding the ending of a comic, I do want to, like, you know, before I even get into our question to kick off our discussion of this comic, I want to go back because you and I had a discussion about the end of the previous comic where I was told in the Spider Slack it was very obvious what was going on at the end of the comic. How could you guys have missed that he was, that Sandman wasn't talking about Spider-Man? He was talking about Flint Marko himself. And I gotta say, okay, fine. Like, looking back on it, maybe, you know, Occam's razor says the missing member of the Sinister Six is who they wanted to break out. Fine. I'm happy to admit that. But I still think that the language of that comic suggested that he was talking about Spider-Man, the proper noun of the sentence that he was in. It was just word salad. So, like, I appreciate the people who wrote to us, because anybody that corrects us clearly cares about the show enough to correct us. And so I appreciate that. But I do think that Mark and I were still justified in our confusion, which is to say, if two people like us who take these things apart at this level of detail were confused by it, it was confusing. Like, the ending of that comic was confusing enough that they had to retcon what, you know, William said in this issue to be something else, because they must have realized what they put to print was confusing. Or maybe not. I don't even know. Mark, do you have anything to add?
Dan, I could add or you know, illustrate that is for, you know, for those of you out there who live to correct us, I just say, San Johnny. I mean, what is that expression? Like, if you have to explain the joke, like, it's not a good joke. Like, let's get into the review. Yeah, agreed.
I just think our reading comprehension skills are stronger than it was implied. But anyway, Mark, two-part stories have been many things throughout the history of Spider-Man, but recently they've been the kind of stories that we have often championed as the best parts of the various runs that we've covered on this show. Dan Slott, you know, Nick Spencer, and even Zeb Wells. I think some of our favorite stories have been the two or three part stories that are sweet and done and not events. And now that we've finished another two part adventure, do you think this latest from Zeb Wells and Carmen Carnero keeps with that track record?
Dare I say this was a bit of a palate cleanser after the thud that Gang War ended on. And, you know, there were some enjoyable bits that came out of these last couple of stories. But, like, there was also a lot of just stuff that was making me scratch my head, whether it be all of the gobbledygook surrounding, like, Sandman and Flint Marko and William Baker and what flower pot he's in and you know, where he's appearing and apparating and not. Or, you know, frankly, even just some of the Peter and MJ stuff where it's like, okay, maybe we're going to, like, get some kind of growth in their relationship. And no, it's just like, no, we're going to, you know, beat back to, you know, that status quo of awkward and painful. In that regard, like, I don't feel like this two-parter did much of anything. I certainly enjoyed it more than some of the previous arcs in this comic, but, like, I wouldn't rank it up there with, say, like, the two-part Dan Slott time, you know, was it the Time Door at Horizon Labs or
No One Dies.
Yeah, or No One Dies is probably a far more epic one. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, No One Dies is, like, the upper threshold of what a two-parter can be. The Time Door was just a lot of fun, and I don't know if it did anything at the end, but, like, it was just a romp all the way through. This, I can't say this was a romp all the way through, and this didn't have the emotional impact of a No One Dies. It was just kind of like, oh, this is fine, and also problematic.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I felt like this was a bit of a palate cleanser. I would put this, like, on the same level as maybe, like, the Vulture story that we got after World Without Love, which I thought was also a very fun story, but not of, like, great consequence, but allowed, like, I would say in that story, JRJR to get expressive with his visuals and do some cool stuff. The thing that that story has that this story doesn't have is the momentum of the run behind it. Like, that Vulture story still felt very, like, tied into the threads that had been established in the previous story with the introduction of this new suit for Spider-Man, and we're seeing it tested out for the first time, and, like, more mystery with MJ being, you know, involved. And this one feels like it's kind of setting up stuff in the future and tying up some loose ends, specifically the, you know, Anna Watson thing. And so I don't think it feels quite as essential as that other story, that other like fun short story did to the ongoing run, which is to say, like, I kind of think that this run has lost a lot of its momentum that it had in the early part of the run, as most Spider-Man runs tend to do the longer you get into them. I don't think this is anything unique to the Zeb Wells run. I mean, like, I think I could point at almost any run of the past history of the book. Like, even Stan Lee and Steve Ditko ran out of juice at the end of the run. So, like, you know, taking this as what it is, I had a great time with it. I thought, you know, maybe in contrast to you, I thought all the subplots flowed very nicely into each other here. I thought at least this issue an easier read and less scattered than the previous issue. Like, it felt like a more kind of direct story, which is like Peter and MJ going back to Ravencroft to prevent, you know, some incursion by the Sinister Six. And so, like, on that ground, I also felt like, yes, this is a two-parter, but this one felt like its own little story in of itself. Like, if I just picked up this up as a Spider-Man comic, maybe I'm missing some of the setup of the previous issue, but other than this is a fun little story all on its own.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, you could say that this issue was more of a proper team-up between Spider-Man and Jackpot, whereas the first comic was more of just a general setup of kind of coming out of gang war. And you know, I think, you know, frankly, what you said about the momentum is kind of the key for all this right now, which is like, and yes, I think in a vacuum, these two comics, and especially this comic, was more linear and structured in its storytelling. But I guess, like, part of where I'm still kind of left a little exasperated is, and you know, granted, I don't know if we got this coming out of the Wyup and Miss Marvel story either, but like, if not for, and you know, you can read our thoughts about this in our Substack newsletter that comes out in the near future, but like, if not for the Web of Spider-Man one shot, like, the sense of like, where is this book going next would kind of be lost on me. I mean, like, we get this like Sinister Six hookup, but like, you know, as we kind of joked in the recap, there's really no sense of where that's going. You know, we're still alluding to Tombstone and his beef with Spider-Man, which we know from the Web of is going to be resolved in an upcoming arc. But like, I guess this is a transitionary story, but I don't know what it's transitioning to based on just the action on the page. And that's what ultimately left me a little cold from it.
We've been saying this throughout the entire run, is like, I think you can really feel the scattered nature of how these books are being put together, which is to say Zeb Wells is writing them all out of order, you know? And so, like, you got set up for something that we might not see, you know, I don't think, based on solicits, we're not going to see the Sinister Six thing pay off for another six issues instead of, like, feeding into it naturally. And, you know, like, I want to be, like, consistent, at least in my criticism, because I do think, like, there are, we constantly praise like the Stern era and stuff like that, and many of those stories don't necessarily feel connected to other stories in the run. They can be little adventures against a villain and maybe the loosest Peter Parker elements to tie it together as an ongoing part of this adventure of Spider-Man. And I do think you get some of that here. Like, I'm intrigued by whatever the heck this Michelle thing is that's going on, and we'll talk about that in a second. I think the thing that's really missing is to tie this all together and give it that heft is like an active protagonist in Peter. Like, what does he want? What are his goals? And, you know, to me, the overriding thing that, you know, I know you and Alan talked about very early on is like this idea of depression and moving on from the past. And that still feels true here. Like, especially in the MJ stuff, it's not just lip service. I think it's still a part of it, but it's not a particularly active role for the protagonist. And even in the action here, like, Spider-Man has very little to do. Like, I guess he pushes Hippo on top of Electro, but this is more or less the Jackpot show, which is fine. Like, develop that in some way, but I think in a more even-handed book, you'd get a little bit more of that team up and feel like how they work well together instead of just them saying at the end of the comic, we work really well together. So it's a little scattered, but I think overall there's like a lot to say favorably about a comic like this. And also, as like I think I said last time, the platonic ideal, like to me, this is much closer to what I want from a Spider-Man comic than what we've been getting for like sections of this run.
Fair enough. I mean, you know, I don't want to belabor it too much here. So you alluded to the Michelle situation a few minutes ago. Man, that was a wild scene. And I mean, to be totally honest, I don't 100% know what to make of it and what I thought about it, because like it was just kind of, you know, she was as my wife likes to joke about certain musical acts. I mean, she was just coming in with second verse energy. You know what I mean? Like, what was your take on what was happening with Michelle and Peter here?
Well, I mean, there's obviously something odd happening. To spend the pages on this, I mean, like, first of all, I'll say I love stuff like this in the pages of a Spider-Man book. As someone who is on the spectrum myself, the autism spectrum, reading Peter in, like, social situations where he's kind of on the back foot and feels like he's kind of left out, I don't want to read, you know, any kind of like autistic, you know, personality traits to Peter. But there is some of that like in him that he doesn't really pick up on social cues terribly well. And, you know, this one may not actually be his fault because Michelle seems absolutely crazy in this situation. But I think this is a kind of like great natural place for Peter to be, which is like whatever some element of Spider-Man in his life is screwing up some social interaction here. And I have to think there's some supernatural element or something from his Spider-Man world that is involving itself here to put him on the back foot. You know, I just kind of like love these kind of like social lack of grace for Peter scenes. And then to add insult to injury that MJ's watching the whole thing, I just thought this was a classic Peter scene.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing that didn't completely drive it home for me the way it did for you, and maybe this is just even how I read it because of, you know, whatever prism I'm viewing this content through. Logically, as you've noted, something somewhat nefarious is going on here, whether it's someone impersonating Peter. We know that we're going to get a Ben Reilly and Chasm story coming up soon. Maybe it's something related to that. Or, you know, hey, you know, what was it? Which anniversary episode was it? Was it our 10th anniversary where you did AI on me and said that I you know, in addition to getting sweet, sweet money from Marvel, you know, I said that annuals count. I mean, you know, like anything on that, you know, there could be some kind of deep fake going on with Peter here. I mean, like it's totally possible. But I guess for me, in reading this, it wasn't 100% clear that even Peter felt like something nefarious was happening. Like he was just like, "What has happened?" Like, I mean, he was clueless, which is, I think, a natural reaction, and it works for Peter here. And I didn't mind. You know, I know I saw some online criticism about MJ being there and kind of, you know, dinging him, you know, nice, you know, wait, you still got it, Parker. I didn't mind that. I thought that was fun. It didn't bother me in the least. Yeah, I guess I would have liked a little bit more of a beat on, like, I don't know, like maybe some kind of inner monologue from Peter, like, is someone impersonating me? Or I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, I think it needed to be a little more on the nose to really bring it home, because, you know, we're making an assumption here, and, you know, I kind of think the assumption is correct, but it, you know, there's been weirder things happening in this run from an editorial standpoint over the last couple of years. So who knows? Maybe it's going to be, you know, this is the new, I love you like a sister. I don't know, Dan.
Well, that's another thing. It's like, you know, as much as I enjoyed it, I do think some of the like writing of the dialogue is confusing. You know, like I had to read it through a couple times to make sure that I was, you know, understanding like what the actual beat is, what Michelle thinks happened, you know, and that might just be because I want to start speculating, but I wanted to be clear on what it was. And it's written just fine, but it's a lot of information just kind of delivered at you, which, you know, it puts you in the shoes of Peter, which is like, what the hell is happening here? And I honestly, my biggest thing is I hope we get more follow through on this as like a one-off thing. It's very strange. Maybe we'll get an issue like this and like in the future, but like, I would love to see whatever this thing is coming at him in multiple ways so that we can begin to like figure it out. You know, my mind immediately goes to like, okay, is Ben Reilly or Chasm messing with his life in some way? That seems like an odd thing for Ben Reilly to do, especially given that his memories are so scattered. And then the other thing is like, Michelle implies a sort of like bad boy attitude to all this. I mean, well, that could put you in Kane, but that doesn't seem like something Kane would do either, you know? So like, I'm thinking, is there like a sinister Spider-Man remnant going on, is, you know, from like the goblin persona? Are we going to get Peter dancing with slicked hair and that's the new way that it has taken on? He's just a bad boy, Parker. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. You know, it reminds me of like the era, you know, post Secret Wars, where, you know, Spider-Man was moonlighting with the Venom suit on, you know, and taking something else is either impersonating Peter or controlling him when he, you know, it isn't aware of it. So I don't know, like, what there is to speculate on. It could be anything. It's an interesting wrinkle for sure.
All right. Well, put a pin in that, obviously. Let's talk about the other major Peter female dynamic in this comic, which is, of course, Peter and MJ, or when she's in the costume, it's jackpot. You know, I don't know how you want to start with this. Do you want to just get into your thoughts on this? Do we want to set this up maybe with a little bit of real world news? What's your pleasure here?
I'm reluctant to get into real world news about the people behind this comic, although you and I do that all the time in regards to our history stuff. And I, you know, we can't truly know the people that are behind this. I mean, we've interviewed people like Jerry Conway a bunch, and so like we feel like we know him in some way. You know, in the past, we've speculated like, hey, you know, like Zeb Wells is married to Heidi Gardner of SNL fame. You know, like there is potential for him to bring insight from that relationship into how he portrays, you know, a marriage or a relationship between, you know, a civilian and someone that is an actor or very much in the public spotlight. And we had brought that up before. And so with the news that broke, I guess, this week, I felt like it's worth at least us acknowledging what happened in, or what we perceive to have happened based on a podcast that Heidi Gardner appeared on, which is to say, she mentioned that she has been going through a painful divorce. And that's not to say like a, she does not imply that it was a messy divorce necessarily, mostly just that it was like, I guess, unexpected and something that they
divorce is rarely
playing out over a number of years.
Divorce is rarely amicable, Dan.
yes. Yeah. And she never names Zeb Wells, you know, on the podcast. But if you know that they were married at one point, you know, it's clearly talking about their relationship. And I think the only reason we bring it up is because, like, one, that's a defining point in someone's life, and you know that there I would find it odd that it wouldn't find its way into the art, especially in a book about two people breaking up and trying to move on. I thought it was worth acknowledging that we found that out this week. I don't know, Mark, what thoughts do you have on this and how we address something like
this? Yeah, I mean, look, I want to be clear about something, because like I have not been exploring the internet, but I can only imagine what some of the discourse about stuff like this is based on, what some of the discourse around Amazing Spider-Man has been for the better part of the last 2 years. I will start by saying, like, when you had sent me a link to an article about Heidi Gardner here, it was revelatory for me when I looked at it, not because like I feel that, oh, you know, Zeb Wells is going through a divorce and he's writing about Peter and MJ being broken up. You know, clearly he hates the concept of marriage and hates Peter and MJ together because he hates his own marriage or hates women or whatever, like, toxic attributions you want to throw out there. I don't think that's what's going on here. With that said, it was a revelation to me because I do feel all artists mine personal experience in their art. You know, I think some do it more overtly than others, but like to feel that like your art is not being guided by your personal experience, I think is naive, frankly. But like, you know, so like with that in mind, with that context in mind, I think in terms of the idea of going through pain and loss in a relationship and how you kind of reconcile that when you still have to see the person, or you're in the same industry as the person, or you're doing things together or have mutual friends or whatever. And I feel like all of those things have been explored to a degree in this comic over the last 2 years. So it makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't want to project anything about what Zeb Wells thinks about his wife or how he's projecting his wife into any individual characters, because I don't think we as podcasters or, you know, people who have, you know, only met Zeb Wells in passing in life have any right to do that. But I do think it's worth bringing up in the sense of like, oh, you know, this is a personal experience. It's a very specific personal experience. It's a traumatic experience. As like I, you know, I was being a little glib before, but there, divorce is rarely good. It's rarely something that you know, like, I mean, as someone who's been married for, doing the math right now, 17 years, it'll be 17 years this year. As someone who's been married 17 years, I've been with my wife. We started dating in 2000. So we have been together for 24 years, Dan. You know, if we were to separate or get divorced, I mean, it would be a very traumatic experience. It's clearly influencing how he's approaching, I think, his characters to some degree. I think it would be silly to think that it wouldn't, to have that, yeah, I don't think any person has the character to separate that, to have that kind of compartmentalization. I'm not even drinking. It's tea tonight, Dan. It's a school night, Dan. You know, I don't think any you know, you'd have to be an ace compartmentalizer to do that. But anyway, I'm rambling a bit, which is to say, I think there's some real stuff going on here in the Peter and MJ sequences. But that said, like, and I think this is where you and I are going to probably diverge the most in terms of our opinions of this comic. I didn't really enjoy it all that much. I found a lot of this problematic and just kind of a little bit more of the same in terms of what we've been doing with these characters, and not in a great way. But what did you think of this, Dan?
I actually really liked it. And I just want to put a pin on what you were saying really quickly, is like, I don't think it's our place to, as critics, to, like, we can know that about what's going on between them to whatever extent is publicly revealed. But I don't think it's our place to speculate based off of the art what's actually going on with Zeb and Heidi in any way. Like, your most charitable reading of this could, you know, of their relationship and how it reflects on the book could be true, and your least charitable reading of this and how it reflects on them can be true. I just don't think that the characters in a book are necessarily reflective of like any kind of reality more than they might be inspired by personal experience, you know. Honestly, I think the portrayal of MJ in the split between Peter and Spider-Man is very kind towards her and less kind towards Peter, and they each have their reasons. For Peter, it was what, like a week or a couple of months, and he saved the woman he loved. And for her, it was many years, and she held out for as long as she could. They both had very different experiences of it, so I think it's charitable to both. But you know, it you know, people are going to claim like misogyny about like this, as they have on a lot of Zeb stuff. And I think we have too in some instances, but like, I don't think any of the writing here shows someone that like hates the idea, like you said, the idea of marriage or hates women or whatever. Like, I think the way this has been written has touched on some of the stuff you mentioned, and maybe not enough, you know, like we'd want more of it if that's the bat route it's going to go down, you know, but I don't think that we can like one, read anything from it or elide the writer as doing self inserts or whatever, what have you. So anyway, I actually like the way that this is handled. And I think weirdly knowing this about Zeb and Heidi, maybe it's coloring my experience of the comic, but it kind of made it a little bit richer in some way. There's just something about the way it's handled that like these two people who I think clearly, and maybe you disagree with on this reading, but like, I think the book clearly establishes that like, these are still two people who love each other. you know, but like due to outside circumstances that they can't control, they are not meant to be together right now. All of these images of them facing away from each other in that one pregnant pause, or Peter landing, like saving MJ and landing on top of her, like, you know, maybe it's tropey, but like there is still care there. And they talk frankly about the feelings that they have in some way, but there's unspoken stuff that they can't really get into because whatever circumstances have led them to not be allowed to. And I think, I don't know, like the I work with my wife at my place of employment for the time being. And we have a very healthy relationship, but like there are like unspoken rules about like how we interact with each other in the workplace. And so like, I kind of thought like, I'd love to see this explored further, but I liked the little that we got here of like them trying to figure out what the line is between each other when they're on the job. And I don't like Jackpot in any other appearances that she has had in any of the other books, but within Wells's run, I've actually kind of enjoyed seeing this version of like how Peter and MJ interact with each other.
Yeah, I mean, I don't totally disagree with any of that. I mean, like, I think certainly, especially like the panels where they're like, you know, where they were like kind of landed on top of each other nose to nose. I mean, frankly, it was probably the most chemistry these two characters had exhibited for each other this entire run. I mean, this is, not that I really thought like, oh, they're gonna get back together at the end of this issue. I wasn't ready to jump to that conclusion, but it was like, oh, wow, you know, maybe we are potentially planting a seed, or, you know, just, we don't know exactly how much longer Zeb Wells is going to be on this book. There've been rumors going around on that front. We're leaving a door open for, you know, either him or someone else to kind of come in and take the reconciliation further. But with that said, I mean, like you kind of in your wrap up of what you were saying, you kind of hit upon what is the most problematic part of this comic for me, which is that, you know, the fact that this is all told through the lens of like, it's not Peter and MJ, it's Spider-Man and Jackpot. And it rubs me the wrong way. And you know, maybe, you know, yeah, I got to get over it and move on with my life. But it's on its face, it's just absurd to me that we're in the status quo right now where, like, you know, Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson are teaming up for superhero antics, and she's, you know, using these like little gauntlet devices that bring up random contraptions. And it's just like none of it makes sense in my brain, Dan. It's just like, I'm not, you know, like it feels very forced and contrived. And like, you know, I would be far more interested in watching these two characters, you know, take the paces that they're taking here if they were doing it as their actual selves, and not this like weird fantasy that's been thrust into this comic without any real reason. Because at the end of the day, like I you know, when we talked about this in our Substack, I don't know what Mary Jane is Jackpot, what it gets us besides, you know, another miniseries and variant covers. You know what I mean? Like what are we truly getting at here? What are we truly, you know, I say this about Peter and Spider-Man all the time when I get really fed up and frustrated with things in this comic book. Like, what are we trying to say with Mary Jane? You know, like I still don't know. And, you know, I appreciate some of the exchanges they had here and the acknowledgement of the loss. I still think that there's a bit of a lady doth protest too much where she's like, no, trust me, it took me a long time to leave you for Paul. I mean, like, yes, I know that it was a contrivance of this time warp, if you will, with in this alternative timeline. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I think that's also trying to acknowledge the criticism that, you know, for the most part, it did not seem like it took that long. You know, it felt very like, oh, now, you know, they were together, now they're not, you know, and it's, you know, I think the more that, you know, the narrative keeps pointing that out, like, no, I swear it took me a while. I think it's just kind of exposing its own flaws in doing so. So like, there's that too. But like, I do think, like, you know, towards the end, like I don't know if we should be doing this. It hurts, you know, like I thought that was real, but like, I would have appreciated the realness of it if it wasn't told through the lens of a premise that I think is absurd, which is jackpot. I just can't move past it.
I think the jackpot, you know me, I'm completely against the leveling up of citizens into superpowered characters. I think I've accepted this because what is being done with it, I think is cool. I think Celeste Bronfman, I'm sure she's a wonderful person, and I think she has real talents as a writer. But I think, like we've said about Solid and Ahmed, like that guy, good writer, doesn't get Spider-Man. Celeste Bronfman, good writer, doesn't really get these characters. And so I think how she established MJ's reasoning for becoming Jackpot, all that stuff is super flimsy. But like what Zeb is using it for, I like. So you said, like, I don't really get why Jackpot. For me, like, these two issues sold me on the concept, which is, oh, the reason Jackpot is because it is forcing Peter to have to continually see Mary Jane despite trying to move on. She is now, you know, continually a part of his life, even in the realm of superhero-dom. And how that works with them interacting with each other, I've really enjoyed these past two issues. And so I can see, like, why this might be a cool thing to temporarily explore. You know, I wish they was more done with it. We wrote that whole Substack about, like, how, like, I wish this was more about following the journey from what Nick Spencer did with Mary Jane in evolving her to not be the woman who is crying at the window when Peter is gone at night, and giving her a little more autonomy, enough to take down Electro in issue 25 of that run. You know, I wish that, like, Celeste had done that in those stories to establish that, so that I could bring that, I don't know, not baggage, that earned character arc into these issues. But, like, on its own, I think Zeb is using this for an interesting idea. And so, like, these are gauntlets. They're a device. They're going to be gone by the time Zeb is gone. So, like, if he wants to explore the messiness of, like, moving on from a relationship but still having it in your face, like, I think this is kind of a cool way to do it, frankly. But I don't expect everyone to agree with me on that. And I expect most people won't. But I've enjoyed reading this dynamic on the page. I can't lie.
Awesome. All right. Well, Dan, why don't we tell the folks out there some other places where they can get lots of opinions from you and I?
Yeah, well, Mark, you and I keep alluding to our Substack, and I think we're going to continue doing that because we keep releasing new ones that I think we're really excited to share with our community. So yeah, if you haven't checked it out yet, our Substack, it's an like about bi-weekly newsletter that Mark and I put together. It comes to your email or to your Substack app, and it's completely free. And you can sign up at amazingspider.substack.com or just search for Amazing Spider Talk or Amazing Spider on your Substack app, and it'll come right up. Mark, what are some of the topics that we're discussing on the newest edition of our Substack?
Well, I think our featured topic is all about Miles Morales again here. You know, we had a milestone issue of Ultimate Spider-Man come out about a week or so ago, Ultimate Spider-Man number 300. We talk a bit about that issue. I reminisce about Ultimate Fallout number 4. I know I promised that in the last Substack and didn't deliver it, but it's in this one, I can assure you. And we also talk about the Hickman Chichetto Ultimate Spider-Man number 3, the Jackpot and Black Hat number 1 that you alluded to. I'm trying to think, was there another
We talk about that Web of Spider-Man.
Yes, the Web of Spider-Man digest. So, you know, like, lots of cool stuff, a little bit, some history bits, some comic celebrate, you know, Spider-Man comic celebrating milestones this past month. So a little bit of history, a little bit of reminiscing, and a little bit of just B-book reviews and other fun stuff. So amazingspider.substack.com. Check it out. It's totally free. Just the blood, sweat, and tears of Dan and myself toiling over a keyboard. So there you go.
Yeah, and I will say too, like, I think a lot of people are asked, like, why aren't we covering Ultimate Spider-Man on the podcast? You know, and maybe that will change as time goes on. I know Mark and I are both digging that book, you know, but this is a podcast that was, you know, established to talk about Amazing Spider-Man. That was our thing, and We've deviated from it here and there. I think what's cool about the Substack and what you and I decided was that was going to be the place for our coverage of that series. So if you really want to know what we think about Ultimate Spider-Man, you're really jazzed by that series, go sign up for the Substack. That's where you're going to get Mark and my unvarnished thoughts on that series. So anyway, speaking of the difference between things, we still have Amazing Spider-Man to talk about. Let's talk about the jailbreak, which is kind of like the lead action of this issue, where Electro breaks in to break out Flint Marko, one half of Sandman, and the other bad guys in Ravencroft seize the moment to escape. What'd you think of this kind of plot, a plot, I guess, for this story?
This was probably the most fun for me of this comic. I mean, I thought we got a lot of, you know, great action, we got some cocky Electro, which is always a good time because, you know, Electro really, you know, he's just basically a nudge above Boomerang in terms of, like, you know, tomfoolery, but, like, you know, he does have a bigger power set, so I guess he can kind of pull off cocky a little bit better. You know, I think the art team, you know, we really enjoyed Carmen Carnero last issue. I think, you know, more of the same, more good stuff here in terms, especially in this sequence, how it was rendered. I just liked the general, like, you know, the orderliness and the kindness of the jailbreak, like Mr. Hyde and Hippo and Human Fly, just like, oh no, we got to do this thing. Oh no, we got to protect Anna. I mean, like, it was, you know, considering, like, just how similar, I guess similar to Jackpot, just like how on its face a silly concept this whole, like, Anna Watson in Ravencroft was, I felt like this was a well executed payoff to that storyline. Like, you know, I think it came together in the ways it needed to be satisfying and yet, you know, silly and fun, but also kind of grounded in the drama of the situation, which was, you know, Electro wreaking havoc and trying to break out Flint or Bill or whatever we're calling Sandman. Can we call him Bill? I enjoyed it. I thought this was great.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought it was great to see Electro back again. I know he's been back since, like, the end of the Nick Spencer run, but I don't feel like he's been given a proper spotlight after he was kind of unceremoniously killed off by Slott. I remember that whole conversation we had about that issue. We were like, that really can't be the death of Electro, can it? And then it was. I have a soft spot for Electro. I think we had that discussion about the Shocker the other day. Like, you know, Electro's the better version of Shocker. And honestly, I like Shocker more than I like Electro. But, like, he does have a soft spot in my heart. And, you know, seeing Marcio Menez get to, like, render the colors of the electricity and how it lights a room differently. I mean, I have all the praise in the world for Marcio Menez and the work that he does on this book week in and week out. Yeah, I mean, I'm just happy to see Electro back, and I want to see an Electro versus Electro story. Like, I'm not okay with him being killed off and being relegated to being, like, a D-list villain. Like, the thing I liked about this the most, and you hinted at it, is, like, the kind of, like, mini arc that we get in this book where it sets up, like, Anna Watson, everybody loves her. She's the potential mayor of Ravencroft. And I know that you and I have had discussions about where is Ravencroft. Is it in New Jersey? Is it in New York City? We'll leave that for another episode of our show that we discuss that. So yeah, where would Anna Watson's domain remain? But, like, by the end, the villains, you know, deciding that it wasn't time for a jailbreak, they needed to do right by Anna and help defeat the Electro threat, I thought was very well earned. And I think speaks again to the thematic elements of this run, which is, like, people rising up above their history, right? Which is to say, like, they aren't going to be defined as just being bad guys. You know, they are going to rise up against the label and stand up to Electro and prove they aren't entirely bad. You know, I think it's a common theme in Spider-Man comics, and one that Zeb has especially honed in on. And so finding a way to work that in here, I thought, elevated the story from just, like, something silly and fun to something that had, like, genuine, like, heart and an idea behind it.
With that said, you know, I joked about it at the end of my recap, but like we had some, I think, narrative confusion, at least for me, and maybe it's just my old addled brain in action here, but there was, you know, we ended the last comic being confused about what is Sandman saying. I was like, what is Sandman doing? It's he's here, he's there, he's in. So what is, I mean, okay, I mean, we explained it in the synopsis. You know, Sandman basically disguises himself as a flower pot, which Anna Watson leaves Ravencroft with, which is what breaks him out. But he left like a shell of himself, I guess you could say, in the form of William, who then evaporates in Ravencroft, and you know, you get the nurse calling for the medic, and you know, and thus Sandman is back with the Sinister Six. This took several reads, and again, it just makes me, if you have to explain the joke, what's happening here, Dan?
Yeah, I think the thing that makes it confusing is like we're not seeing it play out actively. Like we're not seeing Anna Watson be gifted this flower pot. And, you know, so like we're not tracking that. And then, you know, in the scene, William is like working with that nurse whose name I'm forgetting, and they're like potting flowers and stuff. And so like we're cutting between two different but similar looking flower pots, which then like confuses like the time and space of it all. And so I just think there's like a lot of visual confusion going on here. And I think in the moment I got it. It's like, oh, okay. Like there's two, he sent home a version of himself, or, you know, if we want to go back to Dan Slott's run where there's like the soul of Sandman is in one grain of sand, which I don't even know if that's true anymore, or something that was left just like the Lizard or Electro changing their power set at the whim of whatever writer is managing it at the time. So, yeah, I agree with you. I thought it was confusing, but not insurmountable.
Anything about the creative team you want to mention on this comic here, Dan?
No, not really. I think you said it. Like, I think this is a stupendous, you know, artistic endeavor from the creative team. Carmen Carnero, we sung her praises last episode, and I'll sing them again. Sad to see that she's going to the X-Men, but good for her. But I would love to have her on in Spider-Man. This is when we got like big, you know, brawly action scenes. And yeah, we just criticized the visual beats of the ending because, I mean, even the rendering of like William evaporating was really visually interesting to look at. I thought she handled the spectacular action stuff really well too. Like, and Electro looked menacing and exciting, but, you know, and it balanced the silly and scary simultaneously. I really enjoyed looking at this book, and Amazing Spider-Man has not been lacking great artists, but this one is one of real note
for,
I think,
sure. All right, do we want to give this thing a grade?
Yeah, I'm gonna give this one a B.
As you predicted, I'm a little lower than you. I'm giving it a C+. It is a better than average book from me.
Great.
It is that time for all good things to come to an end. So we want to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning into this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
Yeah, this podcast exists because of listener support on Patreon. For only $3.99 a month, you can help support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews, the same week the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. So a thank you to everyone who already supports us and the work that we do. Plus, we wanted to extend a special thanks to our newest contributor, Matthew Sibbald, and to Douglas LaRose for increasing his membership tier.
Thank you both. Dan and I really want to increase all the awesome work we do in 2024. So if you are already a patron or want to become one, please help us meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and click on the big old Patreon button to get started.
And just on that note, this might be a little bit too much sausage making, Mark. I just had to file the taxes for our little business here. And we spent more money than we made. No, but in a good way, because we put all of the stuff that we get back into the quality of the show. Please, you know, if you are considering and you want us to help improve the show, you know, this is a great way to do so. And on that note, you know, this podcast is made not just by Mark and I, but the fine other folks on our team. This podcast was edited by Rick Coast. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galecki. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friend, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge. And our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. And all those people couldn't do those things without the Patreon support. On that note, don't forget to subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on Substack. That's amazingspider.substack.com. So, Mark, until you run for the mayor of Long Island, what's our motto?
I don't have the politics to win that race, Dan. With great podcasts, there must also come the Amazing Spider Talk.
Don't miss the next episode.